The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
This is The Takeaway for Thursday, October 20th, 2016. And here's something new. You have the power to add your voice to the conversation, and it's sitting right in your hand. Download the PRI mobile app to your smartphone and record a voice memo to have your comments featured on the air. It's as simple as that.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. The historians may say it was the battle of an apple and an orange. A power saw and a cruise ship, a truck tire and an egg beater. I'm struggling, I'll admit it. But is there any comparison, really? I mean, can you imagine two more dissimilar debaters than were on stage in Las Vegas last night?
It really does come down to what kind of country we are going to have.
The problem is you talk, but you don't get anything done, Hillary.
A pattern of divisiveness, of a very dark and dangerous vision of our country.
I'll keep you in suspense. When you look at her real record, take a look at Syria, take a look at the migration, take a look at Libya, take a look at Iraq.
Went after a disabled reporter. He went after Mr. and Mrs. Khan. He went after John McCain. He went after a federal judge born in Indiana.
The Supreme Court, it's what it's all about.
We have come too far to have that turn back now.
I am pro-life, and I will be appointing pro-life judges.
Government has no business in the decisions that women make.
I want to build the wall. Hillary Clinton wanted the wall.
It means you would have to have a massive law enforcement presence.
At a later date, we'll make a determination as to the rest. Some bad hombres, we're going to speed up the process bigly.
Did he choke? Well, let me translate that if I can.
We think how great they are. Terminated.
You are the most dangerous person to run for president in the modern history of America.
Lots of luck, Hillary. Thanks a lot for doing a great job.
This is a pattern.
It's what it's all about.
American democracy, it's a beautiful thing. That was the last debate of Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. 19 days till Election Day. Todd Zwillick is here, Takeaway Washington correspondent. You were on the air with some immediate reaction from the debate from voters that we talked to yesterday on this program, a sense of we've come so far, yet we have so far to go between now and Election Day. Your thoughts about the debate last night?
Well, the time for deciding is coming. We're in the final 2.5 weeks where the undecided, the ranks of the undecided, always have shrunk so very much and start to break for one side or the other that if they aren't breaking for you, you're in real trouble.
How you could be undecided now, I can't. That's another question.
About 7% of the electorate, yeah, we think, is undecided right now. That may seem high to you, but that's about...
But our undecideds were interesting. They represented interesting questions about negatives of both candidates and were they able to overcome them. Why don't you go over what was the result last night of our undecided voters?
Absolutely. Let's get to them right now, and then maybe we'll talk about some of the particulars of the debate, because there's a couple of remarkable things in there. So yesterday morning, of course, you had undecided voters from Pennsylvania, from Ohio, Florida, critical swing states. Let's start in Pennsylvania, which I've basically been obsessed with for this whole election, because it really is one of Donald Trump's only paths to victory. Mm-hmm. It's the quintessential swing state. There's a lot of Trump voters in the middle of the state and in the southwest corner of the state. And it's my home state, which is why I've been so obsessed with it. Now, Gabby talked to you yesterday, and Gabby was a Bernie, self-described Bernie supporter, mm-hmm, who had a whole laundry list of
biracial,
yeah, with a huge long laundry list of policy areas that she said she needed to hear Hillary Clinton address before she could get on board. She said she needed to hear her talk about Social Security and an affordable retirement, race relations, minimum wage, affordable college, addressing climate change and a reliance on foreign energy. I mean, she really had a voter's policy
list.
She was
great. She was great.
She was great. She watched the debate. She talked to us right after. And I asked her, Gabby, you've got your list rustling in the background there. You heard the debate. Where have you come down?
I absolutely really, really appreciated her policy experience when it came to Social Security and entitlements. I felt that Hillary Clinton was extremely, extremely well-versed in her policies. She knew exactly what she wanted to do compared to the contrast of Donald Trump, where I wrote down in my notes that really the only thing that he brought up was the topic of repealing and replacing Obamacare, something that personally I benefit from. as a millennial who was a Bernie supporter, now in the middle right now, just looking, her policies were really, really right on. She did mention a living wage.
Gabby predicted that Trump was going to step up and do something that would surprise people and pull them into his camp, and he didn't. And she admitted that last night. I suspect she's slid into the Hillary camp.
Well, she also said that Hillary was reborn like a butterfly in her eyes. Mm-hmm. And Gabby sounds like one Pennsylvania voter who's ready to vote for HRC in this election.
What about John, who is much more a Bernie supporter and an old-style Democratic?
A self-described leftist in Northeast Ohio, which really is a swing state that is a pretty much a statistical dead heat between Trump and Hillary Clinton right now. You're going to hear in John's voice a decision and a little bit of resignation here.
I am strongly leaning towards going to vote for Hillary Clinton, but it'll be the saddest that I've ever felt in my entire life supporting somebody. And what might have finally swayed me tonight wasn't even said during the debates, just that when you vote with your conscience, it almost goes against the idea of voting in the first place. I mean, what's available to voters is laid out each year, and we have to look at it and accept it. But when it comes to Bernie Sanders, what he's done is he's awoken so many people to the depths of the political process and the depths of corruption in this country right now. And no matter who gets elected president, they're going to have their feet held to the fire by a lot of entities that are more powerful than they were a few years ago.
He's talking about what this next 4 years is going to be about. If Hillary Clinton wins, holding this coalition together of Democrats, of Bernies, of Republicans, of centrists is going to be an almost impossible job. The reason why John is so disconsolate about voting for Hillary Clinton is because he doesn't recognize the Democratic Party. It looks like the Republican Party. Hillary represents both the Democratic and Republican parties at this point, and Donald represents something else.
Something that's gone way to the right or way into another realm. Hillary Clinton is, if nothing else, she is the most rational, responsive political actor in the system right now. She's the quintessential politician who will strive to keep that coalition together. Watching her, if she gets elected now, try to weave a path to a reelect in 2020 with the coalition that she has and with the recalcitrant Congress that she's guaranteed to have is going to be fascinating. But as a rational, as the most rational political actor we have, if anyone can do it, it's probably her, I would say.
Give me Cheryl.
Cheryl is in Marco Island, Florida. Now, Cheryl came on the air yesterday, lifelong Republican, said that she was wanting to support a Republican and just needed to see Donald Trump grow up for 90 minutes before she could get on board. Here's Cheryl.
Hillary Clinton is just so polished and so experienced and smiling, and she has such control that this is what she does. And I don't want to say it's unfair, but unfortunately, Trump is who he is, and you get what you get. On the flip side, I feel it's not all bad because he's passionate, and he shows that. He can't pretend to like something if he doesn't, and that can be good and it can be bad. I definitely felt he tried harder. He lost it a little bit, but he was definitely did a better job. I still prefer his policies. I feel that if I go with Clinton and if she wins, we're going to have more of what we just had for the past 8 years. And I'm ready for something different.
So let's talk about the big headline. The huge headline is Donald Trump saying, you know, I might not even go along with this election.
Keep
thing
you in suspense.
You guys are doing. Yeah, it's remarkable.
It's unprecedented in my career. You go back through the history books and you have to go back to the Civil War to find a presidential candidate who says they won't back the results of the election if they lose. This is a remarkable development in my view. And the prospect of a rigged election, despite how unlikely and sort of conspiratorial it is when you look at the facts of how we elect presidents, which is not nationally. We elect them state by state. So you need a conspiracy of literally thousands of people, many of them Republicans, to participate in this.
And this whole conspiracy idea overshadows extraordinary policy choices that were distinct in these two candidates. One is overthrow Roe v. Wade. The other is pro-Roe v. Wade. One is throw out trade deals. The other is endorse trade deals. I mean, sort of.
We'll get there.
And I think that there's more of a choice between Clinton and Trump than there was between McCain and Obama and Romney and Obama, I think.
On policy grounds. But and what's remarkable is the large amount of time that they spent on policy in this debate, and kudos to Chris Wallace for keeping it on policy, that there has been almost no discussion like this of substance in this election because of all the invective. Vote rigging, John, it is remarkable what Donald Trump said. He may be knowing how to stay in the headlines, and he knows how
That's his thing. That's his genius.
Yeah,
he's going to be the guy who's keeping us in suspense, not the guy whose poll numbers are declining
for
the next 19 days.
Which is great for his post-election Trump TV if that's what he wants. However, this is way more serious than that. This also means that millions of voters will go back after this election with an extended idea in their heads. That extension is illegitimacy. Years and years of birtherism said the president isn't really president because he's illegitimate. Donald Trump is going to extend that by saying Hillary Clinton didn't really win, and that has had an unbelievably insidious effect on our politics in Washington.
If that movement finds a party, it will define the 2020 election. If it doesn't, it will just be Trump's bluster.
It will. This is part of the reckoning Republicans have to now deal with right after this election is over. Their November 9th hangover is a huge part of that, John.
Fascinating discussion with Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick.
My pleasure.
He attacked the woman reporter.
She gave us ISIS.
He has given jobs to Chinese steelworkers, not American steelworkers.
Mr. Trump?
She's been doing this for 30 years. Why the hell didn't you do it over the last 15, 20 years?
His whole plan is to cut taxes to give the biggest tax breaks ever.
And she can run for the presidency of the United States?
He was hosting the Celebrity Apprentice.
She caused the violence.
He held a number of big rallies where he said that he could not possibly have done those things to those women because they were not attractive enough.
She's been proven to be a liar in so many different ways.
My takeaway on the debate, that all bad hombres and nasty women and anyone who cares about democracy should be sure to vote.
Rachel Stern calling from New York. Clinton had a plan and Trump had a tantrum.
Hi, this is Laura from Crozet, Virginia. I am calling to say that everyone should check out Evan McMullen, who I am going to be voting for.
Evan is big in Utah. Listener email says, as a person of the middle class, the two major party candidates scare me. Both of them, I feel, will throw me under the bus. The difference will be that after throwing me, Hillary will retire to the country club to hang out with her cronies. Donald will invite his cronies to ride the bus and laugh at us as we are thrown under and maybe even back up to do it again. How can I think anything good will come of this election? That's a complicated and brutal metaphor there, but thank you.
This is Kendra from Deep Red, South Carolina, and I think it's crazy that people are undecided. I don't understand that at all. I don't get what's going on with WikiLeaks. I think that most of the stuff that's come out is very innocuous. It's just regular campaign stuff. And how can you not see that Donald Trump is a unique threat to our civilization?
Hey, if you agree, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Or if you don't agree, head to Facebook. We're at The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. Learn more at TIAA.org.
We hate to fly. Let's agree on that these days. But does anyone think that things are getting better?
This is Jesse from Morristown, New Jersey. I think that air travel has improved. The only delays that I've experienced over the past 10 years have been weather-related and in no way the airline's fault. That wasn't so prior to that time. This is Nicole from Tampa, Florida. All air travel is horrible, and any other industry would not get away with treating its customers so badly. I would love to see an airline come on board that provided the kind of customer service that should be expected when spending hundreds of dollars on a ticket. I would also love to see less crowding. The tiny seating space has made me dread flying. I flew 4 hours home from Canada between two enormous men. It was miserable.
Between two enormous men. That could be the title of the latest Stephen King novel, right? Seriously, folks, this week the Obama administration announced new Department of Transportation regulations to improve the passenger experience. They call for more transparency in the price you pay to fly, and airlines will now be required to refund baggage fees when luggage is substantially delayed. Can they afford it? Did you know that since the airlines started charging for checked bags in 2007, the industry has raked in an estimated $26 billion in those fees? Her job is to report on that industry Americans love to hate. Barbara Peterson, aviation correspondent for Condé Nast Traveler, says it's a very consumer-friendly gesture coming from the White House.
You know, what happened is that I guess you could call it the Obama administration's parting gift to passengers. They just rolled out a bevy of, you know, new protections and rules and all that. And I think the one that stands out as being the most tangible is that, you know, those bag fees that everybody hates because it's for something that used to be for free. Mm-hmm. I think that's what really kind of grates on people. Well, what happens if your bag doesn't arrive with you, that bag that you paid them to carry? Well, it's usually tough luck. You know, it's okay. You know, it'll show up a day or two later. You don't get that fee back.
No, you don't get the fee back. I mean, people are nice to deliver you the bag, but there's no compensation.
Precisely. So what is different now is that the Department of Transportation is saying, no, if they don't deliver your bag to you within a, quote, reasonable or timely manner, and that's, of course, the big ambiguity there, then you'll get your $25 back or whatever you ended up paying.
I mean, if the bag isn't there when you get to your destination, they should refund it. Heaven's sakes.
That seems fair.
Yeah.
But I think this is all about addressing the different demands and the different constituencies. Now, the airlines would argue, well, if we get it to you, you know, within 12 hours or 15 hours or whatever, and that is actually the recommendation that Congress made, then you're okay. I mean, you haven't had your vacation ruined. You haven't had your business presentation totally, you know, thrown off whack. So I think that's what they're looking for. But they haven't finalized this at all. They've just said they're going to do this. And now they'll have a whole period where everybody gets to sound off. And, you know, who knows what will happen? I mean, there's going to be a new administration in a few months. So, again, it's at least a step in the right direction.
Well, we'll certainly get a sense of the public sentiment for more regulations of the airlines and more punitive regulations based on these kinds of fees. But there's no way that the Obama administration can restore a lunch to coach passengers, right?
Oh, yeah. No, nobody's expecting a return to the days when you got all these things wrapped into your airfare.
No.
We really can't put that back in the bottle. But I do think there's going to be more pressure on the industry as a whole to disclose more of these things and make comparison shopping really, easy. One of the things they rolled out with this other proposal on the bag fee is to make airlines at least consider rolling in the fees in the total price that they quote you. So let's say you're a traveler and you know you're going to check two bags. Well, then they're supposed to come back with you and say, okay, here's the total tab. That's a very difficult thing to do, though, because the airlines have effectively put in a cafeteria-style pricing system.
Right. It's a la carte. Totally.
So everybody's going to be different, and you may not know if you're going to check a bag when you book your ticket. So there's a lot of things that still have to be sorted out.
What about scheduling and waiting on the tarmac and the kinds of delays that are really onerous to passengers where they're stuck on a titanium tube for hours at a time?
Well, that is one of the areas where we've seen the most tangible progress. And I do think the administration does deserve a lot of credit for that. They came out in front, and there had been a lot of resistance to doing that. But they did publish this rule, and it prohibits, the airlines from, keeping you trapped, if you will, on a plane, or they have to compensate everybody quite heavily. So it's a couple of hours there. It's it's not like you're going to be released if you want to.
It's so funny, though, because you spend 4 hours on the tarmac, right? And your reward is, here's a plane ticket to go somewhere to get in another one of these titanium tubes. So it's not necessarily the thing that's going to make you, jump for joy, but still it's different than the way it used to be.
Yes. Well, I think one of the things that's putting pressure on the airlines now from Congress and consumers is just that right now there are four major airlines that basically carry about 80% of all the air travelers in the country. So we have a really consolidated industry. So the pressures that used to exist when we had a lot of different players aren't there anymore.
Are the airlines identical at this point, or would you say one or more is more embracing of these kinds of regulations?
Well, I guess that depends on who you flew the last time. No, seriously, it's tempting to look at them as sort of McAirlines. You know, I mean, they're all sort of bland and, you know, they more or less follow each other's lead. I wouldn't say that's totally fair. And I have to give some of the airlines, including, you know, Delta's a huge airline, but they are really trying to, you know, come out there in front and say, we're going to really improve our service. You'll hear that from American, too, and United. So it's there is some competition there. It hasn't been totally erased by this. And then you've got the independent airlines. You've got the JetBlues and Virgin America.
And Southwest, which is hardly an independent anymore. They're so big. But they, you know, make money off of free baggage.
Well, exactly. So Southwest is always the outlier. And in a way, Southwest is another force that keeps everybody else honest.
Barbara Peterson, aviation correspondent for Condé Nast Traveler. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Here's the rough sequence of events. WikiLeaks dumps a whole bunch of hacked emails from Clinton servers that include Clinton staffer John Podesta emails containing the texts of speeches Hillary Clinton gave to some multinational banks. And shortly thereafter, the government of Ecuador announced that it has cut off Julian Assange's access to the Internet from their London embassy, where Assange has been staying for years. Ecuador issued this statement, quote, "Ecuador respects the principle of non-intervention in the internal affairs of other states, but the cat was out of the bag. Listen to this question from last night's debate that came from those leaks and was asked by host Chris Wallace.
In a speech you gave to a Brazilian bank for which you were paid $225,000, we've learned from the WikiLeaks that you said this, and I want to quote, "My dream is a hemispheric common market with open trade and open borders." So that's
Thank
the
you.
Question.
So does that sequence of events suggest U.S. pressure and further that Russia is attempting to manipulate this U.S. election? David Sanger has been reporting the story for The New York Times, says it's a definite maybe.
The question is, was there U.S. pressure on Ecuador to cut off Assange, or did the Ecuadorians just come to the conclusion by themselves that they were becoming a witting or unwitting player in this cyber war that is taking place between the Russians and the United States, in which the Russians, if you believe U.S. intelligence, is attempting to influence the election?
I would imagine that cutting off the Wi-Fi for someone like Julian Assange, already living in an embassy, which would be fairly humble accommodations just right off the top, would be akin to, you know, taking away his oxygen or something.
It would be, but you have to wonder how fully effective that is. I mean, you know, you can travel around the world now with a small portable Wi-Fi hotspot, and you've got to think that Julian Assange has enough friends in London that somebody would be slipping him one. And remember, the WikiLeaks servers are not sitting in that Ecuadorian embassy in central London. They're spread out around the world. Now, if the NSA wanted to, it could shut those down. But that raises all kinds of First Amendment issues, particularly if any of the users of that system are American citizens or any of them run through American infrastructure, and it's good bet good number of them do.
What are sources in the security establishment more concerned about, the infrastructure of WikiLeaks or the apparent Russian infrastructure to feed WikiLeaks this kind of information?
Oh, it's not even close. They're far more interested in Russia than they are in WikiLeaks. In this case, WikiLeaks is just the conduit for getting this stuff out. And you may remember that back earlier this year, the first stolen material wasn't posted by WikiLeaks at all. It was posted by a group or an individual called himself Guccifer 2.0. Now, U.S. intelligence thinks that's probably just a front for Russian intelligence. But the problem was that when they posted this on Guccifer 2.0, no one paid attention. So it wasn't until the same data was funneled off to WikiLeaks, which has got a fairly big base of followers, that it began to have some impact.
So Julian Assange is kind of like the Ellen DeGeneres of illicit data from servers in cyberspace. And his celebrity status is what drives the story. In that case, they're only adding to his celebrity by shutting off his Wi-Fi.
Yes, they are trying to find an outlet that's got a big instantaneous following. And that certainly would be WikiLeaks. We don't know how much day-to-day role Mr. Assange plays in all of this. Certainly, he has a very smart person, and he set things up so that if he was ever cut off, which he knew he was vulnerable to, the system could keep working without him.
David Sanger, national security correspondent for The New York Times, who keeps working no matter what happens in the world. Thanks, David.
Thanks, John.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card, delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
A possibly misguided attempt to foil marriage-related immigrant scams has wilted the flowers for some loving couples trying to get hitched in Louisiana. Hopeful brides and grooms are being turned away at courthouses because of a state law that went into effect in January that requires every foreign-born person to produce their birth certificate to get a marriage license. This week, a man filed a lawsuit calling that law unconstitutional. The Orleans Parish Courthouse turns away about 6 to 8 couples each month for not having the proper documentation, according to the New Orleans Times-Picayune. Mary Yannick is a staff attorney and Lyman Legal Fellow with the New Orleans Workers Center for Racial Justice.
Well, in 2015, the state legislature passed a new marriage license law, which imposes burdensome documentation requirements on immigrants. It specifically makes it more difficult for people who are born outside the United States to get married. In the case that we're working on with our plaintiff who's challenging the law, he's required to produce a birth certificate. But he was born in the Indonesian refugee camp to parents who were fleeing Vietnam. And so he doesn't have a birth certificate. And if he were born in the United States, he could go before a judge with other birth facts, other proof of his birth, and would be able to obtain a license.
So your suspicion legally is that this is an attempt to screen people who come from circumstances outside of the United States that make their immigration status suspect or in flux.
Yes, but it's not just a suspicion. It's a rather remarkable bill that discriminates on its face against those who are born outside the United States. And it's constitutionally suspect to be engaging in discrimination based on place of birth.
Is there a way in which you can get married in the United States that clearly is just a way of getting someone a visa that would be declared illegal by a court? Or in other words, is there ample enforcement right now of existing law that would prevent people from abusing the laws as they exist?
Certainly. Federal immigration authorities scrutinize marriages when there's an immigration application for a status based on that. And there is a lot of federal immigration enforcement, and that's a federal issue. It's not the role of the state to be engaging in federal immigration enforcement through regulating the ability to obtain a marriage license.
What is the toll that this has taken on your client or clients?
It's really been terrible for them, for the people that I've talked to and for the specific plaintiff in this lawsuit, Victor Vo. People can only obtain a marriage license a few weeks before the wedding, and most people in Louisiana don't know about this law. So when they go to the marriage license office and are denied, it's causing a real crisis in people's lives as they're planning for one of the most momentous occasions in their life to celebrate with friends and family. And some people are in situations where they just feel like they have to engage in self-help. They have to go outside of the state to get a marriage license to get legal recognition of their bond. But a lot of people don't have the means or don't want to do that. Our plaintiff, Victor Rowe, he's lived in Louisiana since he was 3 months old. This is his home. He wants a recognition of his marriage in his home.
Is this state or federal jurisdiction based on where you think this case might go?
The case has been filed in federal court, so it will continue through the federal court system.
And could conceivably make it all the way to the Supreme Court.
Yes, it's a constitutional question. We're challenging the law on the grounds that it's discriminating based on place of birth, a violation of the Equal Protection Clause, as well as infringing upon the fundamental right to marry the person that you love, a right that was protected quite recently by the Supreme Court in the Obergefell case regarding gay marriage.
Mary Yannick is a staff attorney and Lyman Legal Fellow with the New Orleans Workers Center for Racial Justice. Thank you so much, Mary.
Thank you.
In Iraq, among the mission objectives in the battle to retake the city of Mosul from the self-proclaimed Islamic State began this week is to get a hold of Mosul's oil revenue and further deplete the ISIS cash flow, which has been reportedly suffering over the past year. From $2 million a day in oil revenue in 2014, security analysts say today that cash inflows are a fraction of that, and rising costs over time has meant that salaries for ISIS fighters have been slashed in half, tax revenues also dwindling. The taking of Mosul would complicate all of those challenges for ISIS. Jonathan Schanzer is a former terrorism finance analyst at the Treasury Department, who's now with the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies in Washington. Jonathan, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So the cash flow is choked off. We should be happy about this?
We should be. And I think that we're going to see a significant drop in ISIS finance. A lot of it is really due to their ability to extract taxes and other fees from the population under their control. And they're about to lose, if Mosul falls, they'll lose about a quarter of their population.
How has the choke hold managed to work up until now? Because the Mosul offensive just began this week.
So the way that things have worked for ISIS over the last couple of years is that they have certainly lost a lot of funding from the drop in the price of oil. That has certainly hurt them. The U.S. has been bombing the warehouses full of cash. They have been taking out oil fields. This has made things extremely difficult for them to operate, and so we've watched their operating budget drop. Of course, we don't know exactly what that operating budget is because ISIS doesn't exactly settle up with Ernst & Young every year. But we do have an understanding that their funds are dropping and that it looks like they're going to drop further.
What can they do to compensate, to issue IOUs?
I think that's essentially what they're going to be able to do. They can also use the cash that they have on hand to perhaps pay people in advance before they lose those cash warehouses. You have to remember that in Mosul in particular, there was one bank that was taken over, and there was roughly $500 million in cash that they were able to extract from that bank. Now, some of that was destroyed from U.S. air raids, but we believe that there was other stores of cash still around, and so they may be able to pay some of their fighters up front.
Is it your belief that ISIS is a self-sufficient operation if it's confined to the territory it controls in Syria, or it's got to get something else?
Well, you know, I think what we're looking at is the evolution of ISIS. We're going to see a terrorist organization go from one that controls territory to one that really operates more virtually. This is the traditional al-Qaeda model, what we saw during, you know, the 1990s and the 2000s, where al-Qaeda lost its headquarters in Afghanistan and was forced to operate in the affiliate structure or in cell structures. So that's, I think, the direction that we're now going to be going in. And that, of course, requires far less funding and could be very deadly as well.
Now, you folks in the sort of K Street terrorism analyst industry there in Washington, D.C., that we rely on so much, are fond of saying that ISIS is extremely dangerous at their peak. They're also dangerous when they're weak. In other words, it's hard to sometimes evaluate the questions of, okay, they're going to lose their money, but they're still just as dangerous. Help me out with this.
Sure. Well, I mean, look, there's no doubt that ISIS has been deadly during the time that it has controlled large swaths of territory. My assessment, I think, may have been contrary to what a lot of people were saying on K Street, which was that this was a very defeatable organization in that structure. Yes, they were deadly in the region, but they were containable. Now that they appear to be scattering, this is where I have more concern, because they're going to be harder to track. They're going to be based in countries across the Middle East. They're going to be based in cells in Europe, potentially in the United States. And so the intelligence tracking becomes more difficult. The infrastructure that we have been tracking becomes harder to watch. So that's the concern that I have. Other people think that this may be a weakening of the movement and therefore good news.
Well, let's talk about that movement. Is the caliphate idea an attractive enough idea that it actually replaces the idea of, you know, blowing up buildings in New York City or Paris, and that if ISIS controls territory, it actually settles down the mission of international terrorism at mega malls in the West?
You know, I think it's unclear. I mean, certainly the idea of the caliphate was one of the things that drew fighters to Syria and Iraq, that they felt that they were, you know, perhaps joining a winning movement and getting on the right side of history. Now that this appears to be breaking up or may be breaking up, there's a question of whether you're going to have individuals who are drawn to the movement because they want to restore the idea of the caliphate or what was, you know, building toward a caliphate. I mean, the bottom line is that the ideology of ISIS, the ideology of radical Islamism or however one wants to define it, this is ultimately the challenge. And this ideology has not waned. We've seen it continue to gain adherence in its various forms really since the 1990s, if not before then.
Is there any question with the decline in revenues that ISIS will have difficulty maintaining loyalty among its troops, and that Al-Qaeda will be in competition, and that there will be a bit of a shakeup there?
Absolutely. I mean, I think what you're going to see is a lot of people who were fighting and were drawing salaries, they're going to be going home. And they will be working out of affiliate groups or cell structures back in their host countries, in their home countries, rather, and they're going to be raising money independently. And again, this is one of the reasons why we have some cause for concern, because it'll be much harder to track.
Jonathan, do you think ISIS, or do you think the Mosul operation is going to be another Aleppo, or is it going to be figured out in the next month or so?
I think it's going to be figured out. I mean, it certainly seems that everyone is on the same page. It looks fairly coordinated. There are going to be some flies in the ointment, but I think in general this does look like a very coordinated campaign, and the hope is that you have a major city in Iraq that will be freed from ISIS control.
The retaking of Mosul, something that Jonathan Schanzer thinks it will actually happen. He's a former terrorism finance analyst at the Treasury Department who's now with the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies in Washington. We'll have to see what that means for ISIS. Thanks so much, Jonathan.
My pleasure.
When you've already changed the world once, you look at a lot of things differently.
In 1990, I was living in Tacoma, Washington, and we were in this little band. And then a year later, we were the number one band in the world. And that shows you how change comes. Then it seems like the mores changed, like for rock music, like the old regime was gone and there was a new regime of music, which they somehow termed alternative music. Like it's an alternative to, no, this is the new rock. It's not an alternative. Mm-hmm.
Chris Novoselic is the former bass player from Nirvana, that Tacoma band that rocked the world with the album Nevermind 25 years ago. As he's grown up, he's maintained a belief that change is possible in America, even in things far away from music. He's board chair of something called Fair Vote, a nonpartisan group devoted to making our elections better. And a measure he helped get on the ballot right now in Maine could be the beginning of a revolution in how we vote in this country. Chris Novoselic wants a system that he says smells more like democracy.
I would give voters more choices. And when we give voters more real choices, we give voters power. And there's a ballot measure in the state of Maine right now for their whole state to use ranked choice voting, a system, by the way, that you had here in New York City a couple generations ago. And it's basically you get a first choice, a second choice, and a third choice on the ballot, and you rank them 1, 2, 3. And so the election officials count the ballots, and if somebody gets a majority of those first choices, the election's over. They want a majority. However, if there's no majority, then the last place vote getter is dropped, and those voters who voted for them, their second and third choices or more are transferred to the remaining candidates until one of them crosses the majority threshold.
Then you're no longer voting for the lesser of two evils. You're able to rank all the evils that you see in a way that is going to actually be reflected in whatever the outcome is.
You can put your passionate, most favorite choice as your first choice and say, well, you know, then there's this one who's really popular and mainstream or whatever, and I can live with them. So I'll put them as my second choice. So I'm not wrecking that second choice.
So being passionate is different from I can live with them.
It is.
And in this election, we don't really have that choice.
You know,
there's a lot of people are making this choice of I can just live with them, and the election doesn't say anything about what they're really passionate about.
It's terrible. You know, we have this consumer culture, for better or for worse, but we have a lot of choices, and we can choose going to a grocery store, what kind of food we buy, what kind of cell phones we want to use. And then with voting, it seems, again, there's this 20th century system. What it seems to be doing is breeding a lot of frustration and fear. People are freaking out. Like on my Facebook feed, like there's people who completely hate Donald Trump. However, they can do nothing else but like post these memes and these negative stories about him like all the time. Like they're obsessed with it. And I'm saying, hey, man, Halloween's coming up. Like what are the kids' costumes look like, or what else is going on?
Yeah, we've settled that. Let's move on.
Yeah.
As far as having hope about the future, your orientation from the music scene and from seeing change happen in front of you, you believe in the process.
Yeah, I believe in the process, and I'm not a crusader, and change can take time. It can happen overnight, or it can take time. So I'm not a crusader, because I've seen crusaders out there, and they're like, the worst case example is a person on the corner holding a sign or with a bell, you know, the end is coming soon, right? Somebody who's obsessed with an issue or obsessed with something. And so when you work within the process, there's a time to do work, but then there's also time to have like a chai or hang out with your loved one, or you know what I mean? Because you're not going to change the world by yourself. So my motto is try to contribute and do good work and then have as much fun as possible.
Were you politically passive at a certain point? In other words, were you the kind of person who would say, oh, I pay no attention to any of that stuff?
Oh, no. You know, I've always like read newspapers, and I was 18 years old. I voted in a presidential election in 1984. I voted for Walter Mondale.
Mondale.
Yeah. And it was in this Union Hall in Aberdeen, Washington, and there's this giant portrait of Lyndon Johnson like looking down on me, who was like president when I was born. Like, there you go, my son. Vote Democratic. You know what I mean? But I'm an independent voter. I vote the person and not the party. And I voted Republican. I voted Democrat. I voted third party, independent.
And this year?
I'm going to vote for Gary Johnson.
Right.
Yeah. So.
And if you were to rank, how would you do it?
I don't know. That's such a hypothetical. Hillary Clinton's going to win all of 12 Washington's electoral votes. So it's just like feel like I'm getting the best value for my vote. And I want to vote somebody who's independent, third party. Makes sense to me.
And if it turns out that Gary Johnson's vote somehow hands the election to Donald Trump in some way, would that concern you?
I just imagine this like Citizen Kane like shot of like the world, and all of a sudden he wins on election night and this camera zooms in on me with my one vote in Washington State. And like, you know, if Donald Trump wins a presidency, that's what people wanted, unless there's some kind of year 2000 craziness happening.
What's it going to take to make ranked choice voting something that gets as much traction as, say, motor voter laws or vote by mail or the kinds of things that have really been pioneered in the Pacific Northwest about the way that we vote?
2.4 million voters in the United States vote with ranked choice voting in 10 cities, and they love it. And the system works, and it's established, and we just need to get more places using it. And we certainly need to keep talking about it. And so on November 8th, Mainers will be voting in their state for ranked choice voting, and it looks like it's going to pass.
So after Maine, where do you think is the natural constituency for ranked voting?
We might have a bill in Congress next year for the U.S. House, because under the Constitution, United States Constitution, Congress makes up the qualifications for how they elect their members. And so a bill would be really important. So we'd like to see the proportional version of ranked choice voting down the road. For now, it's Measure 5 in Maine. It's single winner ranked choice voting. It gives voters more power. You can vote for the candidate you really want to see elected without fear that you're going to elect somebody you don't want to see elected. We need to elect candidates with the best ideas and policy proposals, and not necessarily the candidates with the most money.
Chris Novoselic, thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
Chris Novoselic is the former bassist of Nirvana and board chair for Fair Vote. If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
NYC Now delivers the most up-to-date local news from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. With three updates a day, listeners get breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from across New York City. By sponsoring programming like NYC Now, you'll reach our community of dedicated listeners with premium messaging and an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to get in touch and find out more.